cops in charge in Washington to say marijuana is not the kind of thing that ought to be legalized. It ought not to be minimized. That it's in fact a very real danger. The creating of knowledge that this drug is dangerous. You cannot play with it. It's not funny. It's not something to laugh about. And trying to send that message with clarity that good people don't smoke marijuana.
Then Senator, now Attorney General Jeff Sessions, his views on legalized marijuana are well known. And today, as many expected, he brought federal drug policy in line with those views. Sessions is ending an Obama-era directive that effectively allowed states to move ahead with legalized weed. The Cole memo, as it was known, told prosecutors to focus on organized crime and pot crossing state lines instead. Well, now it'll be up to individual prosecutors how to proceed. The Justice Department calls it a return to the rule of law. David Ball was on Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom's Blue Ribbon Commission on Marijuana Law and Policy. He teaches at Santa Clara University, and he's on the line now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, what does this do to legal weed in California?
Well, it's really anyone's guess right now. One of the confusing things about this directive is that it's really putting all the discretion in the hands of individual U.S. attorneys. And so it really, I think, depends on what the individual U.S. attorneys' goals and objectives are in the particular jurisdictions in which they find themselves. As a reminder, one of the attorneys who did go after a legal marijuana business during the Obama administration was in Northern California, where I am. It was Melinda Haig, and she went after the Harborside dispensary in Oakland, despite the fact that the city of Oakland was a strong supporter of Harborside. So I don't think the fact that we're in California necessarily insulates us from any federal action here. It really will depend on the individual U.S. attorney who's appointed.
So there were no directives other than you're now free to do this, we'd like you to do it, laid out by the Justice Department from Washington.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and I think that's kind of confusing. You know, the Cole memo at least said, look, here's how we'll distinguish between good faith and bad faith, you know, violations of federal law. I mean, it's always been illegal federally, but the federal government can decide what its law enforcement priorities are. And apparently, you know, Attorney General Sessions has seen the figures of tens of thousands of people dying as a result of opioid overdoses and has said, hey, what we really need to focus on is marijuana, which has never actually been involved in a fatal overdose. And in fact, we're not sure if there is even a fatal amount that you can use. And so I'm not really clear, you know, what the directives are. My guess would be that if I wanted to shut down legal marijuana industries on the federal level, I would just pick a few very prominent players and go after them, you know, like Harborside was in Oakland, or, you know, a large farm somewhere. But it's really anyone's guess about what happens. And in fact, that was one of the reports from Kevin Sabet, who's a noted marijuana prohibitionist, has said that he thinks it will dry up the amount of institutional investment that's going into the industry, and that's really what he wants. But one thing that I just want to say is that the rule of law statement that he made, you know, California does have laws about marijuana distribution. It's just that we are choosing to enforce those laws and to regulate it without using the criminal justice system. And I think it's important to not to conflate rule of law with punishing people. Criminal law has proven to be totally ineffective at regulating the war on drugs. All it's really resulted in is a bunch of poor people and black and brown people ending up in prison. So, you know, I think that it's much more effective in terms of keeping pot out of the hands of kids. If you look at the experience of Washington State and Colorado to regulate it in a sort of civil fashion, than it is to just count on arresting people and hope somehow that kids won't have access to drugs.
Well, given past policies and past actions on the part of prosecutors in other administrations, like the Bush administration, what kinds of prosecutions did you see? And would you expect to see those just reintroduced now?
Well, I mean, I think the biggest one and one that a conservative talk show host, Hugh Hewitt, I know has been pushing for is what's called a RICO investigation or RICO prosecution. And RICO stands for Racketeering Influence Corrupt Organizations Act. And it was originally designed for use in prosecuting organized crime among, you know, the sort of the crime families of, you know, New York and Rhode Island and things like that. And what that says is that it really makes it much easier to bring down an entire organization. And so what you could say is that there is a sort of ongoing criminal conspiracy and a commercial entity commercial enterprise that is designed to violate the Controlled Substances Act. And you could use RICO. It's very powerful to go after landlords who have leased property to folks who are involved in the marijuana industry. And even in some cases, I've heard it argued that you could go after the state regulators who have given people licenses to open up businesses where they're selling marijuana. Mm.
Well, so this comes 4 days after it's legal in California. Is that a coincidence, or do you think there's a design to that?
I mean, who knows? I don't think it's a coincidence. I also think the other thing to potentially consider is that there are a number of legislatures in the northeastern part of the United States, New Jersey, Rhode Island, Vermont, and New Hampshire, that are considering legalizing via the legislature. And the first one to do that would be the first one in the country to do so. And this might be a way of either dampening the enthusiasm for that or providing political cover for a governor, say, who wants to veto that. But I think it's certainly not coincidental that California, which is it's projected to be the largest marijuana market in the country, if not the world, has just come online. And, most of the marijuana states, with the exception of Alaska, are all Democratic or all blue-leaning. And so, you would have to ask Jeff Sessions, but I think that there's certainly smoke there, if not fire.
David Ball teaches law at Santa Clara University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
California is also not happy with the federal government's new tax law. The law only allows you to deduct $10,000 of your state and local taxes on your federal return. The average Californian deducts about twice that. So to ease the burden, State Senate leader Kevin De Leon is proposing a workaround. Instead of paying your state taxes, you would give the state that money as a charitable donation. And that donation would be 100% tax deductible on your federal return. Kirk Stark is a professor of tax law and policy at UCLA's law school, and he's advising Kevin De Leon and the Democrats on this proposal. And he's here now. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, how would this work? Would the state have to set up some kind of nonprofit for people to donate to?
Not necessarily a separate entity nonprofit, but they certainly would have to establish a fund to which these contributions could be made, and then the deduction would be claimed on the federal return by any individual who makes a donation to the fund.
Well, making a donation is voluntary, usually, and then
yes.
Paying your taxes is not voluntary. So
yes.
How would you work around that?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So it is true, making donations are voluntary, and the charitable contribution deduction under the federal tax law is for voluntary contributions. And these contributions would be fully voluntary. There would be, no requirement that anyone make a donation to the fund that the state would establish. However, there would be state tax benefits associated with making a donation to the fund.
Couldn't the IRS just say, no, you can't do this? Donations to this fund are not tax deductible federally?
Yeah, certainly they could, for example, they could issue a press release or something like that that says the donations are not deductible. They would have to do a couple things. First, they'd have to specifically disavow a 2011 advisory council memorandum that they issued concerning some Missouri tax credits that did precisely this. They would also have to target all of the other dozens of existing charitable tax credits that are already out there in other states. So, for example, South Carolina and Georgia and Alabama, Arizona, Louisiana, several states have existing 100% state charitable tax credits In those states, those are for donations to so-called school tuition organizations that help to fund vouchers for kids to go to private schools.
Hmm. Okay, so this is not unprecedented.
Oh, no, it's definitely not unprecedented. The two main areas where states have charitable tax credits are these voucher funding school tuition organizations, and then also conservation easements.
Why would the federal government just allow this to happen? Because the federal government could end up losing a lot of revenue if California does this, and maybe New York as well.
Yeah, so I guess first let me say a couple of things. I'd be surprised if California at the end of the day takes as aggressive an approach as, say, South Carolina and Alabama have taken with 100% credit. I suspect it'll end up somewhere south of 100%. But the question would be then, why wouldn't the federal government just step in and disallow these charitable gifts? They'd have to figure out a way to do that. It's possible that they could issue new Treasury regulations. Those new regulations would, of course, have to take into account existing law. So there are several tax court cases that tell us that you're entitled to claim the full deduction for a charitable contribution. So there are legal authorities out there that that the IRS would have to respect if the IRS wanted to take a different view of the law. Congress could always change the law. They could do that through new legislation.
Okay. Let's say California does pass this. And would you anticipate that most taxpayers would do this, would take advantage of it?
I think so, yeah. I mean, certainly it depends on a particular taxpayer's individual situation, but you could decide to make a donation of, let's say, $10,000 to a new fund established by the state. And if they granted you, let's call it an 85% tax credit, then that donation of $10,000 would entitle you to reduce your state tax liability by $8,500, but you'd also get a federal charitable contribution deduction of $10,000 on your federal return, as the current law allows.
So that would be a good deal for taxpayers.
Yeah. So, my understanding is that, California is considering this, New York, there are several New Jersey towns that are also looking at this possibility. So, it's something that's sort of gaining steam.
Kirk Stark, professor of tax law and policy at UCLA Law School. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, how flaws in Intel processor chips are putting all your devices at risk for hacking. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Security researchers have announced two bugs in computer chips that make nearly every computer and smartphone on the planet vulnerable to hacking. If the bugs are exploited, hackers could spy on your data on your computer, on your phone, even on some data stored on the cloud. The two flaws are being called Spectre and Meltdown. That sounds ominous for sure. And for more on this and what it could mean, we're joined by Andy Greenberg, senior writer for Wired. He covers cybersecurity. Hi there.
Hi.
Well, these flaws affect Intel chips, and most computers, right, have Intel chips in them?
Well, actually, they don't just affect Intel chips. Of the two flaws that you named, the worst of them is called Meltdown, and that one focused on Intel chips mostly. The other one, Spectre, actually affects AMD chips and the ARM chips that are in smartphones too. But that there's a little bit of difference between these two. Meltdown was a really serious attack that hackers could pretty easily exploit to steal secrets. Spectre is quite a bit harder, but it's also a lot harder to fix. So that's the one that's going to continue to plague us potentially in ways we don't still understand. We're not still quite sure of how it's going to work, but could potentially cause problems for years to come until we're able to replace these chips entirely.
How were these flaws found, and how long have they been in the chips?
Well, they were found by a big team of researchers. It seems like Google had a lot to do with it. One researcher there is involved in the discovery of both of them. But then really a lot of other universities and cybersecurity companies all teamed up to release this together and get it fixed. And the important thing to note is that they have been fixed. In fact, Meltdown, the worst of the two, is pretty much fixed at this point. And if you install software updates regularly or have them automatically installed, you're probably pretty well protected as it is. Spectre is the one that could keep popping up over the years until not just software is fixed, but the hardware is replaced.
And that's the one that's on your phone?
That's your phone and your computer too, and the cloud. All of those chips are found everywhere.
Hmm.
And we don't know exactly how Spectre could keep haunting us, so to speak, but it is a problem that's not quite as easily fixed as Meltdown, and it's not just in Intel chips either.
Right. So Meltdown's been fixed, but how long was it not fixed?
Probably decades. So
decades.
In fact, this is kind of it sounds scary, but this is kind of a good news story about how this problem that has persisted for, almost as long as most of us have had computers has finally been fixed. And the fact that all of these researchers found it together implies that sophisticated hackers like the NSA or like their equivalents in foreign governments might have found this too, might have found it years ago, in fact, and have been exploiting it all this time until it was released and patched with these software updates. So in a sense, we've all just got a lot more secure.
How would you know if you had been hacked or this had been exploited on your device?
Well, the kind of insidious thing about this is the researchers say is that there is no way to know. In some situations, the hacker would have to run some code, some sort of like untrusted code, something that you download or that you run through a website on your in your browser, or have to run some kind of code on your computer to start the attack. But that untrusted code could gain access to really trusted parts of your computer, like kind of the inner sanctum of it called the kernel. But in other cases, like in Amazon's cloud, one sort of virtual computer on a server, a powerful computer that runs multiple virtual machines, could attack another one. And then there'd be very few ways to tell that ever happens.
Well, given what you just said, that this has been around for decades and we've been blithely unaware of it, I guess it makes me feel a little bit better that, well, nothing terrible has happened, right?
Well, this isn't the kind of attack that, leaves bloody corpses in its wake or something. This is an espionage attack. This is about stealing information. So the fact that that's been happening for decades shouldn't make you feel better, I think. That means that this secret spying technique could have been used for years to steal anyone's secrets. The only comfort is that it's really complicated and probably only the most sophisticated hackers were capable of finding and using it.
Hmm. Well, in a moment, we're going to talk to the reporter who broke the NSA wiretapping story, James Risen. Do you think that this is what the NSA used to spy on Americans?
The NSA has a massive grab bag of hacker tricks that their most elite hacking team, which is now called Computer Network Operations, has available to them. It would not surprise me if this was part of that toolkit, although it wasn't one of the tools we learned about in the recent leaks that were mm-hmm. sort of started by Edward Snowden. They very possibly had this, but they also have a whole lot of other techniques that are kind of these magic tricks to pull secrets out of all of our computers.
Right. Well, I guess if the NSA possibly knew about this but didn't tell us, does that tell you something?
Well, that's been a controversy for years, that the NSA does have, secret hacking techniques. We don't know if they had this one. They haven't commented on it, as far as I know. They didn't say, oh, you caught us. But, the NSA often faces this quandary of, should they use these secret hacking techniques in secret, or should they tell the world, as all of these researchers have done in this case, to get these things fixed? And we're lucky, in a sense, that some researchers did find these two very serious attacks and publicize them with these kind of scary names so that we all pay attention and fix the flaws.
Hmm. Well, meanwhile, there could be other scary flaws, scary named flaws out there that we don't know about yet.
There absolutely are. And the notion that there are these very, very deep-seated vulnerabilities, not just in software, but in the chips, in the hardware, kind of is the most fundamental part of the computer, that is troubling, and it should worry everyone who does computer security, because it means that no matter how much you focus on these sort of higher level parts of the computer, like software, that hardware could undercut all of your efforts and leave us open to spying.
Hmm. Okay, so for the average person who uses a laptop or a smartphone, what should he or she do?
Basically, just if you've been installing updates, then you're safe and you should pretty much stop worrying about it. Some people have pointed out that Spectre, which could still be tweaked in years to come to cause problems, could be used potentially through web ads. So some experts are recommending that you install ad blockers, although as a journalist who depends on advertising revenue for my life salary and everything, I don't know if that's the right solution. But that's one way to protect yourself, is to block ads in the browser. But for the most part, the big tip is you just have to keep your software updated, because software makers are responding to this already.
Andy Greenberg, senior writer for Wired. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, how investigative reporter James Risen broke the biggest story of his career, the NSA wiretapping story, and why the New York Times sat on that story for a year. Editors believe Bush administration officials who said publishing would damage national security.
I think you can't find anything throughout the modern history of journalism that has been published that has really damaged American national security.
James Risen, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Bram. Investigative reporter James Risen has spent his career revealing the secret activities of the federal government, specifically the National Security Wing, the CIA, the NSA. He won a Pulitzer for reporting that the NSA was secretly and illegally wiretapping Americans during the Bush years. But his employer at the time, the New York Times, refused to publish that story for more than a year. Well, now James Risen is out with a lengthy account as to why his bosses were reluctant to publish and why both the Bush and Obama administrations aggressively pursued him and his sources. James Risen is with us now. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Well, you write in your essay for The Intercept that in the 1990s, when you were a national security reporter who covered the CIA, you were working in this, quote, marketplace of secrets. Can you describe what that meant at the time, that marketplace of secrets?
The Cold War had just ended, and Aldrich Ames had been arrested as a Soviet spy. He had been a CIA officer. And the Clinton administration was starting to cut the CIA's budget. And so there was a whole generation of top CIA people who started leaving the CIA. What developed, what I began to realize as I got it more and more into talking to a lot of people and developing a network of sources, is that there was, as I say, a marketplace of secrets where there are a lot of people in Washington who either are in government or out of government or working for a contractor, or who are in journalism or a think tank, who all kind of share information with each other on this kind of conveyor belt of information that goes back and forth among people. And it was this natural organism that had developed over the years to try to avoid surprises happening in Washington. What I realized eventually was that this was like a huge evolving black market, where if you knew the right people and if you were part of this trusted subculture, you could get a lot of information as a reporter.
And then the kind of unwritten quid pro quo was, when the administration wanted something, you know, not published, that would be listened to. That if the administration said,
right,
oh, this is a problem for national security, please don't publish this, the
right
newspaper would say, okay.
Yeah, there was a general understanding that the press would listen and be fairly, I mean, not always, but they would listen to the government when it asked them not to publish a story. And in return, the government would not conduct aggressive leak investigations that would go after either reporters or their sources.
So then 9/11 happens, and it's a different White House. It's a Bush White House, and it prepares to go to war with Iraq. How did that informal leaking arrangement, that marketplace of ideas, how did that change?
You know, after 9/11, the Bush administration used 9/11 as a justification to go to the press all the time to ask them not to publish things. That is when the tension began to build. And then the other side of it, the leak investigations, that whole process began to change with the Valerie Plame case in 2004. The Justice Department appointed a special counsel, Patrick Fitzgerald, to investigate who leaked the identity of Valerie Plame, who was a CIA covert operative, and whether it had been done in retribution for her husband's criticism of the Bush White House on the war in Iraq. And the special counsel, Fitzgerald, kind of blew through all of these informal understandings about how far to target journalists, and he started subpoenaing some of the most famous reporters in Washington or else, you know, trying to force them to talk to him. And he sent one, Judy Miller, to jail for refusing to testify.
And just an aside on Judy Miller, of course, she is cast as a main villain now by people opposed to the Iraq War for banging the drum for reporting, falsely it turned out, the presence of WMDs in Iraq, weapons of mass destruction, and the connection between Saddam and 9/11. You write that you think that she was basically singled out and unfairly tarred because she was a woman.
She has been singled out partly because she's a woman. And also, and it's been much easier for everyone today or in the aftermath of the war to kind of blame her. And that allows them all to forget that virtually every news organization was writing the same kind of stories, all purporting that the weapons of mass destruction existed. But if you blame Judy as an individual, then you can all escape accountability for what you did. And in fact, as I point out in my piece, I was trying to get skeptical stories in the paper about the pre-war intelligence, and they weren't interested in my stories.
And why was that?
There was a climate at the time inside the newspaper that favored stories that made the case for war and more or less ignored stories that were more skeptical on the intelligence.
Okay, so in 2004, you get a tip about a massive story. It's really, as you describe it, the story of a lifetime, and this is the NSA wiretapping story. Can you describe how you first learned about that? Of course, not revealing your sources, but how you found out about this story.
As I said, I was covering the CIA, and I was talking to someone, and they said, I know something that is... I think maybe the biggest secret in the government, but I'm too nervous to talk about it. So I decided to try to continue to meet with this person on some kind of regular basis until this source might be willing to talk about it. And after several months of that, I was leaving a meeting with this source, and I just finally said, look, you got to tell me what it is you're talking about. Suddenly, the source just started telling me everything that... about this program. It was the, you know, basically the outlines of the NSA domestic spying program that we later wrote about and which Edward Snowden later provided more documentation to. So it was a remarkable moment for me. The funny thing is then I found out that the reporter sitting next to me in the Washington Bureau was also hearing things about the same thing as a guy named Eric Lischblau. Once we compared notes, we began to work together.
So you and Lischblau, you go to your editor and you say, okay, here's the story. And then for one reason or another, the editor and other editors sit on the story for a long time.
When we, Eric and I, got enough information together to start writing a draft of a story, it was time to go through what you call as a reporter to go through the front door, which means... contact the press office of the National Security Agency. And I called the press officer And I said, I need to talk to the director of the NSA right now. I just made it sound very urgent. And I couldn't believe it, but she got him on the phone right away. And I just started reading him the top of the draft of the story that Lischblau and I had been working on. And Lischblau was sitting right next to me at his desk, staring at me on the phone. And so as I started reading the top of the draft to Michael Hayden, who was the director of the NSA, after I read the first paragraph or two, I just heard this big gasp on his end. And then he said, well, whatever we're doing is operationally, important and effective and legal or something like that. Then he got off the phone. Pretty soon after that, I'm not sure exactly how long, he called the Washington bureau chief, Phil Taubman. That kind of began about a year's worth of negotiations between the government and the New York Times over the story.
So that was pretty frustrating for you, I can imagine, because here's the story of a lifetime and your paper's not going to publish it.
Right.
So
right, yeah.
you were writing a book at the time and you're like, okay, I'm just going to include this in the book.
This was in the fall of 2004. Right before the election, we had a meeting with the editors in New York and they decided to not run the story before the election. And then after the election, Lischblau and I got them to let us try again. And so we re-reported it and worked on it some more. And then in December 2004, after the election, they killed it again. And I had scheduled a book leave. And they had killed some other stories as well. And so I was really furious. And so I decided to put them in my book, because I figured that was the only way that I could ever get these stories out.
And then what happened when you told your editors that you were putting these stories in your book?
I wrote the manuscript and got it mostly and edited by my publisher. And then in the late summer of 2005, I guess it was early fall, I told the New York Times this NSA story and this other Iran story that they'd also killed are going to be in my book, and, you know, you should publish them in the New York Times. And that began a whole new round of negotiations between me and the editors, and then ultimately between the Times and the government over whether they were going to run the story or not. And that lasted until December 2005.
So they eventually decide to publish it. Do you think it's because they knew your book was going to come out with it anyway and they just wanted to get ahead of it?
Well, that's what I think, yes. I think they have made the case that they had other reasons as well, that we had done more reporting and had more information, which is true. We did have more information. Lischblau got information that showed that officials involved in the program had at one time been afraid that they would face criminal prosecution for being involved in the program because it might be illegal. And that kind of was in conflict with what they had continued to say to us, that the program was perfectly legal. Then we had also found, right at the end, Eric found out that they had considered getting a court-ordered injunction against the New York Times from publishing it. That was kind of electric at the New York Times, because the last time the government did that was the Pentagon Papers.
Of course. So then they thought, okay, we need to do this because this is our...
Yeah.
Is what we do.
Yeah. Right, right.
We're supposed to publish these stories.
Right.
So fast forward to the Obama administration, and they go after you for your book, for what's in it. Not for this story, but for another story on Iran and its nuclear program.
Yeah, it was another story that the Times had not run the request of the government, and I put in my book. First, it was the Bush administration subpoenaed me about my sources for the chapter that story was included in. And then the Obama administration continued the subpoena and extended it and reimposed new subpoenas on me when the judge sided with me and quashed their first couple of subpoenas.
Why was the Obama administration, as you say, and many have said as well, that it was more aggressive prosecuting leakers and journalists than the Bush administration?
The Obama administration really was not press friendly. They didn't like the press. I think they thought that it was a cheap a way to win political points with the right wing in this country by cracking down on the press, because I think they realize the press has no constituency politically. And so it was a matter of convenience for them politically to go after reporters. And they never, I don't think they ever thought about the long-term consequences of what they were doing.
But were they actually convinced that this was a national security issue? Did they think that they were protecting national security by cracking down on leakers?
They've claimed that, but they can't prove any real damage to national security from anything that's been leaked. That's one of the great canards of this whole debate is I think you can't find anything in throughout the modern history of journalism that has been published that has really damaged American national security. They constantly complain about that, and yet when they're pressed, they can never point to anything specific or significant.
And of course, we see a lot of complaint in the current White House about leakers,
right.
And of course, the press and the,
right,
the fake
right.
news.
Well, the one thing that's interesting about Trump, which I don't think he has a clue about, is that he complains about leaks that are just when people say something nasty about him, not about the kind of traditional leak that gets a criminal prosecution, like a something related to national security. And I think he keeps wondering, why are people allowed to say nasty things about him? He has a fundamental lack of understanding of the government.
So what do you think the relationship now is between the press and the New York Times in particular and the national security apparatus? Do you think that because there is this increased hostility between the White House and the press, that the press is more aggressive now? And would the NSA story come up now? Would the Times have had a different response if it were President Trump in office?
The fight that we had over the NSA story in 2005, it began a process of change at the Times over the relationship with the government. And I know today, I just left the paper a few months ago, and I know today that they're much more aggressive on national security reporting, and they're much less willing than before to agree to hold or kill stories at their government's request than they used to be. That was true under the Obama administration as well as Trump. I don't think it's because of Trump. Mm. But I think also Trump is such a wild card and so unpredictable that it's almost makes it difficult to cover national security in any coherent way right now.
Why did you leave the New York Times?
Well, I've been there 20 years, and I thought it was a good time for change. I think there's a limit on how long you can try to cover national security on a daily basis. It's very intensive. It was just a good time for me personally.
So it didn't have anything to do with what you're writing about, your frustrations?
No. That was, this happened several years ago, almost about a decade ago, really.
We asked for comment from the New York Times, and they said they're not commenting on your story.
Okay. Well, I got comments in the story from a lot of people who were directly involved. So,
well, James Risen, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. That's James Risen, investigative journalist, and you can read his new essay on The Intercept's website. It's called The Biggest Secret, My Life as a New York Times Reporter in the Shadow of the War on Terror. Coming up, art critic Carolina Miranda on the end of an era in Echo Park. An experimental art gallery closes its doors after 15 years. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Carolina Miranda is back now to talk about the latest in LA's art scene. She writes the Culture High and Low column for the LA Times, and she is our regular art person. Hello.
Hello. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Let's start with, on a kind of a sad note, the closing of an art institution. This is a radical storefront gallery named Machine Project in Echo Park. It's been around for, what, 15 years?
Yes. I'd say it's a happy, sad note because I think they're going out in style. These artist-run spaces usually don't last for very long. It was founded by an artist named Mark Allen back in 2003. And, you know, usually a lot of artist-run spaces are a little bit fly-by-night. They might be around a year, or two or three, maybe even five. And 15 is actually a very long time for a space that, an alternative space to be around in that way. And I think he saw it as a project that he would do for a certain amount of time and that sort of once that had kind of ended for him, he would just end it. So I think it's they're going out in style.
And why are they going out?
And I think, well, they've been around for 15 years. They're a small arts nonprofit based in Echo Park. They work a lot with experimental artists, emerging artists, artists who aren't being shown in galleries or in museums, doing really radical stuff. So, you know, over the course of the space's lifetime, they've staged, you know, bizarre performances in the windows. They once turned the gallery into a forest and they had a pig running around.
A real pig?
A real pig. You could get your kids photographed with the pig actually as part of the show. And then experimental plays by Asher Hartman down a spiral staircase in the basement. These very avant-garde types of production that require a lot of energy to maintain and produce and fundraise and pay the rent. And I think Mark was had sort of felt that that chapter in his life and in the institution's life had run its course. And now there's a lot more other experimental spaces in Los Angeles as well, and that it was time for him to move on to other stuff.
Mm. And so did it have an effect on the larger art world?
I think it did because it was one of those really important feeder spaces. You know, this was a space where artists fresh out of college could go and get a show and experiment, and it would be okay to fail because there was no plans to sell anything. There was no plans to even get reviews. The whole idea was that this was a space where you just went and tried crazy things. And so, for example, one of the earlier shows they did by Kamau Patton, who is, you know, back then was just a graduate from Stanford, had just received his MFA. Did a show at Machine Project. He's now a professor at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. He's done presentations at LACMA and at MoMA. And it's these kind of spaces that nurture those types of artists, that provide them a platform, provide them with a space in which to work out ideas. And he did this crazy thing in which he turned it into this kind of functioning public access television type studio where he would record these fictional shows in which he would play all the characters. And it was like a combination of black radical politics and esoteric Erica and 1-800 numbers. Like, it was this very unusual thing. And so try finding a commercial gallery
right
to fund something like that. So very important for experimentation and for helping emerging artists rise up.
Okay. All right. And you mentioned that there are other places now that are filling that niche here in LA.
Well, I think, you know, there has been those types of spaces all along. All along, there have been these kind of alternative artist-run spaces that have nurtured that kind of scene. I think, you know, we're certainly at a point where there is a flowering of them. You know, you have everything from spaces like Five Car Garage in Santa Monica, which is like a gallery slash performance space that is literally in somebody's garage. And they do remarkable shows there. You have places like the Underground Museum in Arlington Heights, which is working with local artists in Los Angeles, but also international artists for shows and programming that bring together those sort of like highbrow international and local elements of the art world together in one space. You have Laura Owens's 356 Mission in Boyle Heights. You have all of these different spaces that are also kind of serving that need. And I think Mark had just done it for 15 years and it was just time.
And time being January 13th.
That's the final day. For every show they've ever done, Mark had a silkscreen print commissioned to commemorate the show, sometimes by multiple artists. And so those prints are going to be on sale as part of the wrap. And there will be a wrap party. And knowing Machine Project, I'm sure something unusual will happen. Maybe a live pig.
One can only hope.
Yeah.
So that's January 13th. All right. So moving on to an exhibition that's at the California African American Museum. That's in Exposition Park. It's called We Wanted a Revolution, Black Radical Women, 1965 to 1985.
Yes.
And what is this about?
This is a terrific show that came out of the Brooklyn Museum in New York, organized by Catherine Morris and Rujeko Hockley. And it's a look at essentially feminism through a feminism and art through a Black female lens during that era, which is the era of the Black Power movement, the sort of the latter part of the civil rights movement, the women's movement. And looking at the types of spaces Black artists were making for themselves, and specifically Black women artists, publications they were making, you know, these kind of circles of artists, these are often voices that are left out of the mainstream. So the story, to some degree, is how these women created their own publications and galleries and performance spaces and guerrilla actions in a way that made sure that their voices were heard. And another aspect of the show is just a little bit of sleuthing. You know, there are a lot of pieces, because a lot of these artists weren't necessarily shown in major institutions at the time in which they were working. It's, you know, curators going in and digging out pieces from private collections that haven't been seen in close to 50 years. So like a really, you know, one might say explosive piece by L.A. artist Betty Saar in the form of a Molotov cocktail. There's prints by artists who have since passed away. So this exhibition that goes back to look at the history of feminism and the history of art and revise it a little bit and make sure that that female Black voice is included.
And speaking of that, we did a piece on the show. Her daughter, Leslie Saar, has an exhibition in that same museum.
Yeah, the whole family is actually represented at the California African American Museum right now. Both Betty Saar and her daughter, Allison Saar, are in the We Wanted a Revolution exhibition. And then a couple of galleries down, Betty Saar's daughter, Leslie, has a solo exhibition of paintings and other works on view. So it kind
of...
You got
the whole family.
You got the whole family.
It's
kind of an incredible opportunity. They're all incredible artists in their own right. So to be able to see their work in one space is always a nice thing.
Okay, that space is the California African American Museum and Exposition Park. And that exhibition closes soon, January 14th.
January 14th, so you just got a couple weeks.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Carolina Miranda, The LA Times. She writes the Culture High and Low column there. And Christian Bordahl is here to round out the hour with
listener
feedback.
Hey there. Well, you discussed earlier how Attorney General Jeff Sessions has rescinded this thing called the Cole Memo. You know, that's the Obama-era memo that basically said the feds wouldn't bother going after pot businesses or users in states that have legalized, like California.
Right.
So now I guess federal prosecutors are free to...
Do whatever
crack
they
down,
want.
Yeah, exactly, on users again in California and businesses. Well, Mike McGill says anyone choosing to pay 37% tax to buy legal pot instead of continuing to buy it from their guy is an idiot. You didn't have a problem buying illegal pot before. Freedom with strings attached isn't freedom. It's just the state allowing you the perception of freedom as long as they get their cut. Greg Hayward says hypocrites. Which is it, GOP? States' rights or not? Be sure to pay your federal taxes on your weed sales, even though you can't use our banks. We don't condone it. Hypocrisy 101. Krista Itchak says, Congress will act. Too many states have overturned prohibition, either medically or recreationally. The feds don't have the resources to change it. Obama said so in one of his last interviews. Jurors and local law enforcement won't punish people following local law. It's going to get declassified and end prohibition at the federal level.
Hmm.
So we'll see if that actually happens. I did put out a little poll to see whether this will change people's habits. 70% said nope, they're going to continue doing their pot the way they normally do. 3% said yes, I'll be more careful. 1% says probably I'll buy a little less or use a little less. And 26% says I don't do pot, so it doesn't matter to me.
Doesn't it feel like this whole law has kind of arrived with a big shrug? Like, ah.
It definitely, yeah.
Doesn't feel like
it
a
also
lot has
feels
changed.
Like there's... Like we're a state at war with the federal government, like with the tax thing, and now, you know, the drilling, offshore drilling that's just announced. It feels like civil war.
California. Uber Alles.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Christian Bordahl, and thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.